Session number 9902, Reel 5.
To get some plum wine.
If I could go back to the... and I can ask you personally that later. Yeah. But about this business of the communist infiltration, would this have been before your husband died during the war, or would it have been after the war, when your students were missing?
Well, Gordon was still in Chiang Kai-shek's employ. And he'd come to Kunming, and he was living in a Chinese house with me, and I was going to the school every day. But all the best students were suddenly disappearing.
Yes, and this would have been during the war period, would it?
1948.
Oh, that's after the war, yes.
Well, it was after the bombing.
Yes, but after the war had ended with Japan.
Yes.
That's what I was really trying to establish. Yes,
this was the beginning of the Mao influence.
Yes,
you see.
But if I could keep still strictly to the war period, and then we will go on to that period later on. Who were the other European or Western people
in Kunming?
In Kunming, yes. Was there a British military mission there?
There were people coming up the Burma Road, and bringing in oil. Because that was the most important thing, to bring up the Burma Road, because we couldn't do anything along the coast, because the Japanese had closed up the coast. And the only contact with the outer world was through Lashio and up the Burma Road. And that was our only connection. We even brought medical supplies from the Red Cross that way. And you can imagine that these packets and big boxes of quinine and other things were being pilfered all along the way up the Burma Road. And I, myself, realized that Gordon wasn't getting the latest drugs, even though the Canadians had a lot of medicine.
Now you're going to 1948, though, aren't you, when he was ill?
Yes. But I don't know, you see. I don't know what happened on the coast at all.
No. And I don't. No. I think, really, if we could keep to the wartime situation, and I was asking you about the other Westerners in the area.
Well, now, in Kunming, this was mostly French.
Yes.
And they were coming out from Indochina all the time by a very wonderful railway, which I believe has been destroyed now. From Hanoi to Kunming, there was direct railway which had been built by the Italians. And it was a most marvellous thing. It was over ravines and wonderful bridges and so on. And it was a Michelin car which had only one, I don't know what they call them. It was run on with rubber tyres. I don't know what you call it. It's a Michelin car.
Did you ever meet any members of the Friends Ambulance Unit?
Yes, Rui Alley, I knew.
Did you?
Well, I didn't know him personally, but we sent up all kinds of supplies to him, who was in Lanzhou. And he used to send... And he began the commune in northwest China. He was a New Zealander. Did you know his name? And... It's only recently that I got a book which tells you something of his work with the communists, because I think he was a very dedicated communist, and he felt that communism was and the cooperatives, he was in charge of industrial cooperatives, and I think he had an enormous influence on the development of Mao Zedong's communes.
Did you know about him at the time?
Yes.
What he was doing?
Yes,
the sort
I did.
Of work he was doing?
Yes, and I met a lot of the young men who were bringing up supplies from different parts of China to stop these communes in northwest China. Yes, and I know that Shui, who had been very independent, you see, down in having his own college outside the university, was very much... in that movement of cooperation, because he had to succumb to cooperating with other people at Lanzhou University. I mean, he was in charge of the foreign languages department, which meant Tibetans, Russians, French, any, and we were the first time, for the first time, had an English department. So he started the English department. Of the, they'd never seen any English people before, and except did, missionaries. Yes.
Well, was he connected with Ruy Ali Shvey at all?
He wasn't connected with him at all. I think, you see, in a way, Chinese are anything that is most profitable to them. They're rather like Jews. I mean, they'll join anything that will benefit them in any way. It's the first time they had an English department at that university.
Yes. Could it, did you know, and is there anything else you can tell me about Ruy Ali and his sort of communes? Because, you know, we are quite interested in the work he was doing.
Yes. I've got a book.
I'm not so interested in what you've read. It's what you knew at the time.
No, I never met him.
No. The other thing was, I was asking you about the Friends Ambulance Unit, wasn't I?
Yes.
And this is where Ruy Ali came in.
Yes, he did.
Did you ever meet any members of the Friends Ambulance Unit?
I met quite a number of young men who came and stopped with us in... I was just wondering where we were living at that time. We had a courtyard in the university, and this is terribly scholastic, isn't it? We had no electricity. We had to use oil lamps, and we had no plumbing, so we had to use, open ditches where we had a sort of our own private bathrooms, but it was, we had water carried to our bedrooms, and we had little basins that we washed in and did our hair in. And it was so cold that we more or less had to be sewn into our clothes for the whole winter. We didn't take off our padded clothes for 6 months of the year because it was too cold to take them off. And that is why only...
Yes, don't forget, it's the Friends Ambulance Unit. You're going to tell me.
I know that they came up by road from Greja, I think. No, Chandu. Chandu over the mountains, and Chiang Kai-shek and I think had a tremendous battle there and killed a lot of people because they were always saying, Chiang Kai-shek is our greatest enemy and he's killing everybody who's passing through here because he thinks that we are taking the strength from his army. And of course there was fighting going on right up to the time when he evacuated to Taiwan. I mean, there were battles going on in different parts of China. And of course eventually he came down, I think by boat, from Tsingtao or Shanghai to Taiwan with the remnant of his army, because he went to try to it wasn't to do with the Friends, but you see all these people were partisans. They were either for Chiang Kai-shek or for Mao, and a lot of them had already become followers of Mao, who was a communist.
I was asking you about the Friends Ambulance Unit earlier. You were saying you met sometimes the young men.
Hmm.
Did you know who they were? And you know that they
I can't
were pacifists.
Remember their names now.
Did you know that they were pacifists?
Well, I knew that they were. Yes, I knew that they were pacifists, and I knew Peter Goulard, who was a pacifist. Now, his is the only name I know, because he came to live in Kunming. And he wrote books. He was partly Russian, partly Dutch. He was a mixture of nations.
Was he a member of the Friends Ambulance Unit?
Well, he'd been sent to...
Oh, not... No, I won't worry about him, but did you know the work the Friends Ambulance Unit was doing in China?
Yes. Well, they kept passing through in these trucks.
Did you know what they were carrying?
They were carrying medicines, and they were carrying... books? Oh, they were carrying anything that people wanted. I don't think anything in particular, no. I can't remember.
Mm. I wonder if you formed any opinion during this sort of war period about the Kuomintang and, you know, their treatment of the, A, first of all, their own troops.
Oh, I think it was all appalling. They were on starvation rations. Oh, yes, Chiang Kai-shek had to get his soldiers from anywhere. And, of course, at that time, a soldier was supposed to be expendable. And the value of life was non-existent. I mean, if a man died in the route march, he was just swept to the side of the road and forgotten until some friend probably came along and covered him with leaves or something. I mean, the value of a human life was absolutely... A soldier was old rusty iron that wasn't useful for any other purpose than to be put into the army. I mean, the army was used as a kind of rubbish heap for anybody. It's really ghastly. I mean, life in our society has only just begun to be valued, hasn't it? I mean, in the Middle Ages, you remember, people used to be swept into a cesspit if you got cholera. Were brought up to feel that the scholar was important, so they became governors of provinces. And professors were. And anyone who taught was supposed to be all right. But a tradesman wasn't of importance, though, of course, nowadays... They become, if they get money, directly they get money, they become merchants and some importance. But there was a hierarchy, the Confucian hierarchy was important then. Then Mao said that the farmer was important, the most important, you see, and that he did change the quality of life.
Yes. Going back to the Kuomintang and their regime... Did you form any opinion as to its effectiveness and honesty?
I felt myself that Chiang Kai-shek did as well as he could. And Madame Zhang was a very good influence for a time because they had this new life movement and they all did their own part in the running of hospitals. Now, when Mao came in, and he came in a red engine... into Kunming, and he put all he
this
himself
was when he entered Kunming,
when the communists entered Kunming.
Were you there? Did you see that?
I actually saw the army of students with pitchforks on their shoulders instead of rifles. None of them had rifles. All of them had implements of farming or to show that they worked on the land and were for the people. I can't remember all that happened, but I know they marched from the university right down the main streets of Kunming to take over the city from the governor, because the governor had decamped to go to some other place because he didn't want to be there when the city was taken over by Mao, or Mao's governor. I saw it happen. But I happened to be standing with people from Yunnan University. One was a professor of Chinese. And I said to Jiang Guoming, I think his name was, Jiang Guoming, you better not be seen talking to me because it might be held against you. Oh, he said, I don't care. They all know what I've been doing. I've been living with my family quite peacefully in the university compound and doing my best. I've been teaching Chinese, and that's not a criminal offence. And so he was rather poo-pooey, but he's still, as part of the university, I went over to China, you see, in 1982, and I went to Kunming and asked where Jiang Yiming was. Oh, yes, he's still in the university. But I never saw him. And Kunming has now become one of the health resorts of China, because during the war they found that this was the most glorious climate where any plant would grow, profusely.
Yes, I think you mentioned that earlier, you know, in the lovely sunshine.
Yeah.
But, you know, I wonder if I could go back now again to the entrance of the Red Army into Kunming. You know, what was it? How did you feel about this? Had you? What did
I was
you
afraid,
think of
I was
communists?
Afraid. I was afraid that some of my friends would get into trouble because they had been talking to foreigners. You see, I instinctively realized with my foreign friends, like Miss Harris, who could speak Chinese very well by the time, she said, the Chinese will not want us, Myrtle. We'll have to go out by the Burma Road. So we immediately asked our trading friends who had trucks going down whether we could have a truck to get out by Baoshan and Lashio and down the Burma Road. And we went with, we were allowed to have 20 silver dollars with us, and we had to go down by charcoal truck and had to be guarded by Chinese police. And be,
these would be communist police.
Yes, well, yes, because all the whole of the Burma Road then was patrolled by the Maos. Mao had come in by that time. And so we went under the new regime guards. We were supposed to be... I had a pass that was... I think I still got it. It was... I had to apply for a pass to go down the Burma Road to Kunming. To Peking, I'm sorry. To Peking, from Kunming, I had to get permission to leave because I had Chinese friends and foreign friends who could speak Chinese, and they vouched for both of us, Miss Harris and me, to go out with this Chinese trader with this lorry. And I had to apply with a Chinese letter to Peking. That took a long time. It took us 6 months to get a pass to go out. And eventually the pass came. Mine was numbered one, and Miss Harris was number two, a pass with a the Chinese star that was imprinted on the pass that showed you that we were communists. And this was a pass sent from Peking, where the central government now was. You see, they immediately made Peking again the capital of China. And that still remains, because historically it's always been the capital. And you see, it was moved to Nanking, Beijing being the northern capital, Nanking being the southern capital, and Chongqing being the middle capital, you see.
During the 6 months that you were waiting for your pass, how were you treated by the communists?
We were treated as prisoners, in a way, because we had a woman cook, and she said, I'm not going into the market again, because the soldiers stop me, and they count how many eggs I've got in my basket. So everything, you see, had to be rationed. And if a cook came and said she wanted 10 eggs, well, 10 eggs... How many people in the house? Two people? And so they would confiscate what they thought was too much, you see. And everybody was watching everybody else.
Did you have any impression of how the people were treated by the communists compared with, say, the nationalist government?
Well, I did know that because our Chinese professors were very outspoken. And one of them, who was a very bad sleeper, and she said, well, I did feel that I got more politeness from this set of soldiers than I did from the last set. I mean, that's the only way they could compare. And she said, I have now realized that we are going to have a period of peaceful living, where everybody is going to consider everybody else, and that if I haven't a good coat on, that won't make any difference. If I have a cotton coat on and not a silk one, I should probably be treated better than if I had a silk one. And this Jiang Yuming, whom we knew very well, he said, well, something new's happening. I said, what? He said, I went into the bank and I wanted to cash something or get my allowance for some reason. And I had my cotton gown on and I was given precedence. I was put at the head of the queue. Instead of a silk padded coat, that was no... you could take people by their appearance, you see. This man in front of me looked like a rather rich merchant or something. The poorest person was put in the first place. And so that was a change of attitude to the poor. And so the poor people were put first. And that was very... at the time, it seemed to be rather wonderful. And even students were being orderlies in the hospital, you see. They all had been trained to do particular work. And some of them, of course, were very good at reading letters and so on. And they were put in charge of all kinds of offices and banks and things. Everybody had a job to do, and they tried to do it as well as they could, because they had been trained, and they'd been at these training schools all round the country. They'd gone with their picks, all their farm instruments, perhaps. Rather, you see, the... What was rather, it's you again get categories of people who are more important than others. I find nowadays people who have, in this house for instance, who have no eyesight or no hearing at all, they are privileged. If you can walk into the town, you're not.
I was wondering also, you know, one hears about inflation in
that
Chiang Kai-shek's time. You know, did this...
terrible.
Was that
because, you
up?
See, we had our wages at the university were paid in Chinese dollars, and the dollar became useless or valueless. If you had a cage full of 1,000, it might buy a cabbage. If you had... if you had a very valuable vase, you might exchange it for. It became bartering very often, because the dollar became of no importance at all. Your wireless set would become your most valuable possession, and you'd probably sit at the side of the road to sell it in the morning to buy a little bit of food for yourself. If you couldn't get food from your own farm or your own friends, you might have to sell all your possessions, you see. And that became very fundamental.
Yes. When the communists did achieve victory in China, and you were there after all, did it surprise you, you know, having experienced the life? And
well, you felt that all the servants that you had in your house would go home. And we had a female cook at that time, and she said, I have to go back to my village. And you see, they didn't feel safe unless they had their family around them. So then there was a great going, after all this tremendous upheaval in the whole of China and people walking from one end of the country to another to escape the bombing, now the trail back home began. And you found, you say, to... Wong, where are you going to tomorrow? Oh, I'm going back home. I said, where's home? Oh, somewhere in Zhejiang in the east. I'll have to walk there. I may be able to get a few lifts in a truck or something, but mostly it'll be on foot.
But I wondered if you were surprised that the communists achieved victory, you know, bearing in mind
yes.
the strength of the nationalists and the backing they had from particularly the Americans. Did
yeah.
it surprise you, or... you know.
Well, you see, we had seen the American army coming up the Burma Road, and that was and of course they came in their large American planes, and I saw a good deal of the American army, because some of them were deputed to go down to Burma to keep the Burma Road open for the British, who were occupying Burma at the time, because they had come in from India, you see. And the British and the Americans were joining up in Burma, and the number of American soldiers who were rather high up in rank. Some of them were colonels, and well, there weren't any generals. You see, General Stilwell had an army which collaborated with Chiang Kai-shek, but of course he was used by the nationalists to bring the American money in. You see, by this time there had been a consortium of banks that were watching the situation, and if one lot were winning, well, you had to be on their side. And I never met anybody who was near Mao, but I knew that Mao was behind. And when Mao took over in Lanzhou in the north, Miss Harris and I, who had been working there for 2 years, we flew back to Kunming, and that was when we got out, because we knew we weren't wanted anymore. Yeah. Because Mao was anti-foreign. There's no doubt about it, he was. The communists are anti-foreign. Everything must be Chinese. Even a lift or a plane must be made by the Chinese. You know, they had these village what are they called? Factories. And when I went to China in 1982, which of course was well after Mao's death, they were still proud of having built the railway from Lanzhou, or no, Chengdu, to Kunming with their own mechanics.
Yes. While you were in Lanzhou, you know, during this period up to 1948, were you actually working with Ruy Ali?
No, he was further along the way. He was actually in the country.
Yes, you didn't actually go to his school.
No, he was... I think he was a Quaker, was he? I don't know. Anyway, I've got this... Well, anyway, I didn't realise that... I knew he was an important person because he had these communes, industrial communes, already working in that part of China, but I didn't actually meet him. You see...
Ruy Ali at that time?
Only in that part of China. Only in the northwest. And I think the Australians and the New Zealanders were a kind of battering ram for the Chinese at the time, because they were very much more classless. And I think that really is why now they're making a very great impact in American and British life. All the films are coming from Australia. They are rather... I don't quite know how to put it, but do you know Clive James?
If I could just ask, you know, go back to this question. Did it surprise you, bearing in mind the Kuomintang strength, that they lost China?
Oh, yes.
It surprised you?
It didn't surprise me in that I knew how much we suffered. We were suffering. We had nothing.
And was it their mismanagement? You know, why was it the communists won and the Kuomintang lost, do you think?
It was the ideology. Sharing. The fact that the professor came to say, oh, because I had a cotton coat on, I didn't have to go to the end of the line. I was put in the front. I mean, it was really a case of the poorest should be first.
And that's why you think they won? They won China?
Because Mao had the right idea. He went to the important people producing the food. And food is the most important
thing. The peasantry.
Yes. And if he'd gone for industry, no. And that's where Stalin went wrong. He began to build factories, didn't he? And that isn't the lifeblood of the people. Food, bread, is. And that is why Mao won. Because he went for the farmers. Oh, yes, I do think that. And I think it's the same in any country.